You've your hands full, I suppose, with Charles and Molly. Charles isn't so bad. He just talks. Molly's the worst. What, little Molly? She steals. No. And here was me about to check her shoulders for wings. She steals my tips to buy buns. And does she share? Does she hell? How come you're so cheerful, then? Do you qualify for some kind of prize if London is finally destroyed?
I don't know. I'm just happy.
She put her arm around his shoulders. Idiot. He leaned his head against hers.
Fool.
Work on your vocabulary. You wouldn't want Charles to get ahead.
No, I wouldn't, you bonehead.
Stop it, she said, pinching his arm. Both of them laughed, and then a woman passing in the opposite direction lifted a blue-gloved hand and slapped Mary full in the face. The shock put her on the ground, with bright points of light flashing. Zachary was kneeling over her, one hand under her head to keep it off the flagstones, the other hand smoothing her hair away from her face. "I'm quite all right," she said. "I'm fine." His shock was too much. She collected herself and managed to sit upright. He looked as if he might cry.
"Don't," she said. "It's not your fault."
She looked around for the woman who had hit her, but it seemed she hadn't stopped. There was only the city, in irreconcilable fragments.
"Help me up," she said. "It's nothing, you know."
She smiled to show that it really was.
"Let's go to the river, shall we? And regroup."
Down at the Thames, the water flowed as it always had, and the soft breeze smelled of the sea. The tanned longshoremen worked their lines, while the brown tide swelled beneath them. Mary thought that everything might be fine after all. But as they sat on the wall, now that her back was to the city, she began to sob. She couldn't stop.
"It's all right," said Zachary. "It's all right."
"It's not all right."
Her voice shocked her, shrill, brittle. The attack had knocked the last of the morphia out of her. Her face was hot where the woman had slapped it, but her body crawled with ice. Her bones froze and cracked. Her hands shook so hard that she had to ask Zachary to take the bottle of morphia from her bag. He held her head and managed to get a dozen drops into her mouth. She was beyond shame, not caring that Zachary knew what she had become. After a few minutes, the pain was chased from her bones by a warm and forgiving kindness. Zachary's eyes were on her.
"All right," she said in a hoarse voice. "I'll give it up."
"Sorry,"
said Zachary, and threw the brown bottle into the Thames.
"Oh,"
said Mary. It didn't matter yet. Morphia dulled any feelings of despair at its disappearance. The worst imaginable eventuality, that of the morphia being gone, was the event for which it was the only cure. What a perfect trap it was, and all her own work, too. Even Hilda could not have sprung it better. Now the air raid sirens began. They soared up, and she was amazed at the thrill in her chest as they started their downward swoop. May 1941. Back at the theatre, Mary taught the children all afternoon. She invented a game for Zachary. The letters on a page were enemy soldiers he'd captured, and he had to interrogate them individually. If he never gave the letters a chance to compare stories, they couldn't conspire to swirl and change and confound him. She had him use his thumbs to isolate each letter and sound it out. In this way, he made quick progress at reading the commoner words, and she saw again his expression of mild disappointment when there turned out to be less sorcery and reading than he had imagined. They enjoyed themselves so much that she had lost track of time in the windowless basement, and when the air raid began, she was stuck underground with the children. It was the worst night of bombing so far. The earth lurched and liquefied. London seemed to bleed. Mary watched, astonished, as red fluid streamed down the walls of the Lyceum's basement and puddled on the dance floor. It seemed impossible that anyone would survive, and when the all-clear sounded, it was the most unlikely flourish. It was as if a conjurer had flipped a coin 1,000 feet into the air and made it land on its edge. She left the children to sleep, and went to see if the garret was still there. It was, though its windows were blown in. She didn't mind. What was important was that when she fished in the dustbin for the last discarded bottle of morphia, there were still a few drops in it. She took them, then ran water into the bottle, rinsed it around, and drank it. When she began to feel more domestic, she swept up. The window glass sounded lovely as it surrendered itself to the dustpan. This was what the best composers would write from now on. Orchestral scores for broken glass and brooms. She threw the morphia bottle in with the shards. She smiled because this was so ingenious. By tossing it in with all the other spent glass, without ceremony, one would move on from the whole episode. Withdrawal from morphia would be perfectly manageable. She placed it in that category of hardships over which the faint-hearted made a terrific fuss, but which could actually be borne quite readily by a person who had been brought up to put on a sweater rather than complain of the cold. The withdrawal would be more of a melancholy than a suffering, like taking the train home after a holiday in Devon. The May morning blew in unimpeded. Even if there was smoke, it was a tonic after the stale air in the Lyceum basement. Mary couldn't find the makings of tea. She looked out over the London, but the city didn't seem likely to furnish her with tea either. It stood in stunned silence, with white ash upon it in a shroud. Flames crackled here and there in the ruins. The morning cast a directionless shade through the smoke. She hoped she might find a cafe open somewhere. She put on an overcoat of Alistair's, rolling up the sleeves. In the Strand, the ancient sundial of St. Clement's made no shadow. Nothing was open. She wandered to the river. The waves were anxious and pale. Tea, she thought, half remembering why she had come. The word sounded in her head without finding meaning. Tea. E. Unrequited, like the bleating of herds in thick fog. Mary sat on the wall of the embankment, her back to the disheartening river. In the silence of the morning, no traffic moved in the streets. Women with ash faces and charcoal eyes swept neat piles of glass and mortar, neat heaps of splinters and flint, neat barrows for all that was lost. Now Mary began to feel uneasy. The music no longer seemed delightful. The hissing of the brooms carried a whisper that life was cracked and gone. That any life left behind was not the good kind, which stubbornly built on rubble. Aside from the brooms, there was silence. London was a stopped gramophone, with no hand to wind it. It smelled of cracked sewers, and escaping town gas and charred wood, wet from fire hoses. How hadn't she noticed this? The ageless mechanism of the city's renewal had faltered. Women only waited now, and swept. Rope cordons ringed unexploded ordnance. Chalk crosses marked the doors that the rescue crews had not yet opened. Mary thought of the mortuaries with their unclaimed dead lying in senseless paragraphs, line after line with an X against each body in the ledger. The point to which she had hurried at the start of the war was gone now, along with all fixed points. Now X marked only the unexploded, the unexamined, the unconsoled. One waited, with the shuffling rhythm of brooms, for some inexplicit resurrection. It overwhelmed her. Every sense was scoured raw by the retreating grit of the morphia. The Thames was the issue of all the world's wounded hearts, the billions. The pale brown flow was unending. Oh, she half remembered, I came out to find tea. The Thames was before her, infinite and inexplicable. How brown it was. Oh, she thought, I came to find tea. The Thames was... Oh. Hilda answered the door in her nightdress. The left side of her face was bandaged and pinned, the eye covered. Blood showed through. What happened? Said Mary. After a pause, Hilda said, I think it's my cheek. Goodness, Hilda! Oh, Mary, your face! Do I look dreadful? Mary made herself smile. It always looks worse than it is. Well, come in, won't you? Hilda moved with care, her neck painfully straight. Mary followed her through to the little kitchen. She ran water into the kettle and put it on the stove. The pressure was feeble, and the gas made a minuscule flame. Mary said, I hope you like your tea slow. Hilda slumped at the kitchen table. Mary hugged her. What happened? New driver. Stupid little thing. We dodged bombs all night, and then she put us straight through a UXB cordon. The crash set the horrid thing off. Mary's stomach turned.
Oh, Hilda, I'm so sorry.
How bad do you suppose my face is? They wouldn't let me look.
Does it hurt?
Awfully. Like it's still being cut.
Do you have morphia?
Hilda gave her a look. Are you asking for me or for you? Mary closed her eyes for a moment.
Both.
I'm trying not to use morphia, unless it gets desperate.
You're shaking enough to bring down the building.
But they need it for the soldiers. We really have been so thoughtless. Mary took her hand.
But how else can one live through this?
As ordinary people do. We must learn to live with no help on our own. Mary said nothing. After a while, Hilda said, Sorry. Mary shook her head.
Do you have bandages at least? You're bleeding through. Let me change them.
Hilda swallowed. In the cupboard over the sink. Mary fetched bandages and antiseptic. She had Hilda sit back in her chair while she undid the pins.
Does this hurt?
Only horribly.
I'll be as gentle as I can.
The bandage came off, dragging clotted blood and saffron-coloured serum. Hilda yelped.
Sorry, said Mary. I'm so sorry.
Hilda was shaking so hard that Mary couldn't hold her.
Try to keep your hands off your face. Please, you mustn't touch it.
Mary clasped Hilda's hands together and held them. Dabbing a clean bandage in the antiseptic, she cleaned the wounds. It was hard to do it properly. She was shaking almost as much as Hilda. When she was finished, she took a careful look at Hilda's face.
Now you must tell me where the morphia is.
Hilda whimpered.
Is it as bad as that? Tell me where it is, darling, and then I will bring the mirror.
Hilda hesitated. The left side of her face was gore, the right was fear.
Be brave, said Mary.
Hilda closed her eyes and said,
Hand back. Good girl.
Mary took two serrets, and they used one each. Hilda took a deep, shuddering breath.
You were quite right, of course.
Cigarette? Said Mary, offering.
Rather.
Mary tuned the wireless. The Kentucky minstrels played Love's Old Sweet Song. The sharp midday light softened into afternoon.
Fix your hair?
Said Mary, after a while. No answer. Hilda's cigarette, forgotten, drooped a sadness of ash. Mary fetched Hilda's hairbrushes and got to work. Hilda was sleepy and loose, and she would keep coming towards the brush so that Mary had to nudge her head upright again. With the wireless, they sat in warm silence while Mary worked, and once Hilda's pompadour was restored, Mary used hairspray to put it out of bounds for physics.
How's it looking?
Said Hilda.
Fine. I'll fetch the mirror, shall I?
Oh, yes, do. When Mary brought the mirror and set it on its stand on the little formica-topped table, they held hands and looked together. There were three cuts, all beginning on the left cheekbone. The deepest ran back towards the ear. The longest curved downwards, almost to the point of the jaw. The cruelest ran towards the eye, missing the eye itself, but resuming on the other side of the socket to cut through the eyebrow and end in a nasty bifurcation on the forehead. The cuts had been stitched, but not very well. Mary imagined the scene at the hospital, the worst night of the bombing, the floors streaked with blood.
You've done a much better job than last time, said Hilda.
Oh, thanks.
The trick is really to get a good tight curl from the start, isn't it? And then the rest looks after itself.
So long as one doesn't spare the spray.
Well, it isn't on ration, is it? The way I see it, hairspray is proof that the War Office wants us to be happy.
They want us to be upstanding. Hairspray is their talisman.
By the way, said Hilda, did I tell you that poor Hugh was killed?
Oh, dear, said Mary, the morphia making it no more serious than a bun that had rolled off downhill.
And Clive, at the same time.
What a shame, said Mary, wondering if Hilda was dead too, and then realizing that of course she couldn't be, since here she was now. It was hard to keep up with who was and who wasn't. Hilda watched herself in the mirror, softly at first, and then rising to a piercing scream, the kettle finally boiled.
Oh,
said Mary, who had forgotten. Outside the kitchen window, the city tended to evening. Mary looked out and remembered there was a war. She made tea in the brown glazed pot, with leaves that had been used before.
"That's right," thought Mary. "I came out for tea."
Something had changed in the set of Hilda's shoulders. The stiffness had come back to her neck again. There was a brittle edge in Hilda, and also in how Mary understood Hilda's mood. Mary found it hard to explain to herself. The morphia had levels, visible from below but not from above. Without taking her eyes from the mirror, Hilda said, "I expect I shall hate you once this wears off." Her own thought seemed to surprise her, and she followed it by saying, "Oh." Mary poured them each a cup, in which neither of them had the slightest interest, and set to work to redo Hilda's bandages. Hilda said, "This wouldn't have happened if you'd been driving."
"You know the ambulance was too much for me. I had to stop. I only carried on because I thought you'd come back. You've taken it all from me now. Every man I ever liked, and now my looks."
Mary fastened the bandage with a pin, though it spoiled the hairdo a bit.
"I've tried to make it up to you for Alistair. You know I've stopped writing to him."
"Well, now you might as well. He won't want me now."
"No one will."
"You mustn't say that."
"But you must see it."
"Please,"
said Mary, not really knowing what she asked for. Hilda said nothing. The wireless crackled and jived. Mary finished off the bandage and pinned it.
"It will heal, you know."
"As if anything does."
They snagged eyes in the mirror then, and Mary caught something bleaker than she could bear in Hilda's face. The whole world was shattered, the pieces falling away from each other. The morphia was hardening as it cooled. Soon it would shatter too. Outside, it was looking like dusk.
"I should go," said Mary. "The raids."
Hilda emptied her handbag on the table. Lipstick and keys clattered out. Ration book, hat pins, a dozen cigarettes of morphia.
"What are you doing?"
"If you care about me at all," said Hilda, "take all these doses away."
"Why?"
"Because you have to live with yourself."
Mary tried to take Hilda's hand, but Hilda wouldn't let her.
"Please,
just go. Before this one wears off completely, and I tell you what I think of you."
Mary cast down her eyes.
"I suppose you rather have."
"Please go," said Hilda. "I don't think I can stand you any more."
Mary looked at the cigarettes on the table, knowing she must leave them where they were, but also that it was impossible. She picked up six of the doses, turned, and left the flat without speaking. The last she saw of Hilda was her slim back and the armoured black curve of her hair. Part 3. Restoration. July 1941. Alistair had Briggs wrap the painting in blankets and take it to the fort's central courtyard. He followed Briggs down. A month on, Alistair still found it hard to balance without his arm. One had never realised how quietly an arm just got on with the business of equilibrium, counterbalancing here, giving a little nudge there. One hadn't suspected that life was a circus trick, requiring exquisite balance and grace.
"All right, sir," said his subaltern.
"Quite, thank you, Briggs."
"You're not, though, are you, sir?"
"No," said Alistair. "Go and find the quartermaster, will you, and have him issue me with a new right arm, salutes for the execution of."
"Gives you much pain, does it?"
"Think how much pain it will save me. I can never hit my thumb with a hammer again. It's you chaps I feel sorry for."
"Thank you, sir. Help you with anything else, can I?"
"Left pocket of my jacket. Pill box. Take two out, would you, and find me a drink of water?" The man fished out the pills and brought Alistair a canteen. The truth was that the pain was a bore, worse than it had been before the amputation. The phenacetin helped only a little, and in the meantime his evacuation number was taken forever to come up. He was still only 80th in the queue, with a single mail flight leaving the island every day if enemy action permitted. Often one's number rose up the queue only to fall down again when some brass hat pulled strings for a favourite of theirs. And the mail plane carried only two casualties home at a time, sometimes one.
It depended whether the island's garrison had found much to write home about.
"Anything else?"
said Briggs. His subaltern was skin and bone, painful to look at. Alistair supposed he might not look any prettier himself. He nodded at the painting.
"I need us to take this back to a church near the Benjema Gap. I want you to persuade the quartermaster, using all the arts at your disposal, to issue us with a truck and a ration of petrol. Note that I have spent 3 months restoring this painting. It is the best work I have ever done, and it means everything to me to get it back. I don't suppose you can help the QM not to be a bore about it."
Briggs thought for a moment.
"I shall tell him it's maps for the anti-invasion plan, sir. If that doesn't work, I'll tell him I know what he does with His Majesty's Vaseline."
"Thank you, Briggs. You are wicked in a way that is thoroughly expeditious. Bring me the QM's chit, and I'll sign it. Don't speak a word of this. In return, I shall issue orders for all bombs and shrapnel to miss you by at least 200 feet from now until the day of our victory."
"Thank you, sir. Very handy indeed."
When Briggs brought the Bedford up and loaded the painting into the truck bed, Alistair got the cab door open and struggled into the passenger seat. Briggs drove them across the drawbridge, the fort's gates swung closed behind them, and they were out in the blue morning. Alistair closed his eyes, too weary for chat. At least the nausea of the infection was gone. In its place he felt a sort of grief. He must have loved the arm, in a way. He didn't know what had become of it, whether it had been incinerated or buried. There had been no words to mark its demise. There was no ritual when one fell apart, society preferring to wait until one was lost entirely. The surgeon had given Alistair a briefing that lacked no medical detail.
"This articulation of the elbow, with amputation through the joint, pronator and dermal flaps to be folded over, stitches to effect closure, the whole to be done under anaesthesia induced by intravenous barbiturate. Sound about right to you, old man? Any questions?"
"None," Alistair had said, since the obvious one, "How will I possibly bear it?" seemed unwelcome. The operation would have seemed less daunting if the surgeon had been able to acknowledge, even tangentially, that it was an awful thing to happen to a person. Perhaps there were simply certain procedures, such as wielding a scalpel or firing a 3.7-inch anti-aircraft piece, that were always going to affect the subject more than the operator. The truck lurched and swayed on the ruined roads. Briggs whistled. In the intervals between the deepest potholes, the motion was soothing.
"Isn't it something, sir?"
Alistair opened his eyes. Briggs was indicating a sweep of countryside beyond the walls of Valletta.
"Oh, you like it," said Alistair.
"Me too." "The people can't do enough for you. It's like Liverpool, only with beaches."
"Think you'll come back on holiday?"
"After the war, I'll bring my wife here and we'll open a pub."
"Good show. Germanic or traditional, do you think?"
"I think the English style might be more of a hit with the locals, sir. At least for the next 1,000 years or so."
"You have it all worked out."
"Don't you, sir?"
"Oh, I don't know what I'll do after the war. But that's officers for you, isn't it? Each pip on these epaulettes represents a point we're missing."
"I'm glad you've said it, sir. I couldn't possibly."
They drove a little way further, and then a 20mm shell from an enemy 109 shattered the windshield, punched through Briggs's chest at the level of the sternum, and continued through the driver's seat. 4 more shells followed, 2 piercing the cab, and 2 coming through the canvas canopy. On impact with the truck bed, the shells disgorged hot phosphorus into the wood. Fragments pierced the fuel tanks and lit them up. Alistair was out of the cab immediately, the battle instinct delivering him to the roadside ditch. He watched the truck roll slowly off the road and take fire. Briggs made no sound as he burned. The truck went up with an orange roar and clouds of black diesel soot. Alistair scanned the sky, but saw no sign of the fighter. He scrambled from the ditch and went as close as he could, holding his left hand before his face to shield against the heat. The truck's canvas back was burned away, the metal hoops arching over a bed of embers. He went up to the cab, looked at Briggs, and wished he hadn't. Up and down the road for 30 yards he searched both ditches, hoping that by luck the painting might have been thrown clear. The road snaked away in both directions over low hills, its yellow gravel losing its distinctness in the yellow grass of the verges and the yellow stones of the walls. He couldn't get his pipe lit. After an hour, a local man came by in a donkey cart. They said prayers for Briggs, and Alistair rode back on the tailgate of the cart. At the fort, he reported the incident and stayed on his feet as far as the stone staircase, where he sank to his knees before he found the resources to climb up to his room. He only wanted to close his eyes for a few minutes to collect himself, but the fort's bells began almost immediately. The fresh attack came in, the bombers dragging their shadows across the cerulean sea. Alistair took the jar of Tom's jam from the arrow loop and put it safely on the floor. He sat on his cot and got out the phenacetin. He almost called for Briggs to make coffee. After the raid, Simonson came up with an aerogram. He flipped it onto Alistair's desk, took off his cap, and threw that at Alistair.
"Damned if I know anyone would write to you. I got two letters, by the way, in case you were wondering which of us was the more popular."
Alistair stretched for the letter. Simonson slouched in Alistair's chair.
"You know what worries me about the enemy? It's the violence. It is almost as if he thinks he can solve every problem this way. I sometimes feel we shall have trouble rubbing along."
"Please don't joke," said Alistair. "Briggs was killed this morning."
Simonson said nothing.
"It was my fault," said Alistair. "I had him drive me, and we got lit up. I was taking my painting to the church to give it back."
"No other cargo?"
"None."
"No other purpose for the journey?"
"I'm afraid not. I falsified the requisition, said we were taking invasion maps to the outer fort."
Simonson closed his eyes.
"Lost at Bedford, too. Burned. They'll bring you my report."
"What about you?"
said Simonson.
"Are you all right?"
Alistair stood, balancing with an effort.
"Briggs had a wife."
"Children?"
"No."
"Well, that's something."
"I shall have to write to her," said Alistair.
"Do so, and then move on and don't brood. You must be kind, of course. Write that he was killed by enemy action during a liaison operation."
"Yes, but I'm telling you the truth, Douglas, as my senior officer."
"And what would you have me do? Court-martial you?"
"You'll probably have to, won't you? When the Lieutenant Colonel sees my report, I shouldn't think you'll have much leeway."
Simonson stood and paced.
"You're a first-class officer, and in any other circumstance, you would have been back in London long ago, invalided out. You're exhausted, and you show poor judgment, that's all."
"It isn't as if I've stolen a tin of margarine. I've killed Briggs."
"The enemy killed him, and you must live with it as you can. If I were you, I might weigh it against all the ones I had saved."
"Oh, but who keeps count?"
"God Almighty keeps count, you fool. And when he loses count, he checks with me, as your commanding officer."
Alistair had been flipping the aerogram over and over in his good hand, absent-mindedly, and now he noticed that it was from Hilda. The ghost of his hand moved by instinct to the flap of the envelope and pushed a thumb under it before it realised, with a feeling of absolute surprise that Alistair shared, that it did not exist. He overbalanced, his left arm having compensated for the movement of the phantom right. He fell sideways onto his cot. The aerogram fluttered to the floor. While Alistair struggled to a sitting position, Simonson retrieved it.
"Here,"
he said.
"Let me."
"Please don't," said Alistair.
"I'm not in the mood to read it."
Simonson ignored him and opened it.
"Do you mind?" said Alistair. "Don't be so precious. We could use some diversion, don't you think?"
"Dear Alistair, I'm sorry to write to you under difficult circumstances."
"Oh," thought Alistair.
"Mary has been killed."
His blood began to stop.
"I find it my duty to tell you that Mary has been acting outrageously."
Alistair went light with relief.
"Mary is your girl, yes?"
"I'm not sure."
"No one is ever sure. And who's this Hilda?"
"Her friend.
Here, give that back, won't you?"
Simonson held the letter beyond his reach.
"Your Mary seems to have got this Hilda's backup."
I will come to the point because it is something you have a right to understand, since I know that Mary has been writing to you.
But she hasn't, has she?
Not for months.
Or so you claim, said Simonson.
Just read, will you, or give me the letter.
Simonson snatched it away. I am sorry to say that she has given up her duty on the ambulances and become a slave to morphia. Out of loyalty, I would have said this was her business, but now our friendship is finished, and I feel a duty to you that I no longer owe to Mary. Please know that I admired you from the moment we held hands.
You dog!
But it isn't like that, said Alistair.
Says you. I think we must let Hilda tell us what it is like.
The worst of it is that Mary is consorting with Negroes. She spends days at the Lyceum and carries on as if it is the most natural thing. I suppose the morphia is her only counsel in the matter. Of course, it is too awful for her parents. Their name suffers. I need not tell you how people talk.
Simonson whistled.
That really is the limit.
I'm sure it's nothing.
Of course it's not nothing. Damn it, man. You look as if the devil has you by the scrot.
I wish you to know that I do not hope to reopen anything between us. My circumstances have changed, and I would not be an attractive proposition to you in any case. Rather, please know that I choose to close things between us by discharging the duty of honesty that I owe you for the kindness you once showed me.
How does she sign it? Said Alistair.
Sincerely.
I see.
And of course you are thinking bitterly, but you will see that she is right, I'm afraid. If half of what she says is true, then you are best off without Mary, and this Hilda has done well to warn you.
I should like to know Mary's side of the story.
I shouldn't be curious. Niggers are niggers. There's no consortable kind. And morphia, my God, it's filthy stuff. It's for doctors and whores.
Alistair flushed. Mary taught children who were killed. And there was a friend of mine she was practically engaged to, and he was killed too. One makes allowances.
One makes allowances, Alistair, for fatigue and pain and misjudgment. But morphia and blacks? The woman is utterly fallen.
Women fall differently, that's all. We die by the stopping of our hearts, they by the insistence of theirs.
Oh, do give it up, Alistair. She's lost.
I don't believe that. Everything can be restored. If one won't believe that, how does one endure all this?
One doesn't have a choice, which makes the decision easier.
Alistair sighed.
Anyway, I like her. A medic once told me to find a nice girl and forget the war. And so long as I think of Mary, I can.
So you won't give her up?
Not even if I wanted to. Doctor's orders, you see.
Well, poor Hilda's letter seems to have backfired, wouldn't you say?
Oh, Hilda's not a bad egg, you know. She's funny and rather pretty and... Oh, in another life, a girl like that.
Yes, but it is rather a desperate letter.
It is rather a desperate war.
Simonson put his arm around Alice's shoulders, and they looked out at the sea.
What shall we do about you?
Said Simonson.
There's nothing to do. I'll accept what punishment the Lieutenant Colonel thinks fitting. In the meantime, I'll arrange a burial detail for Briggs.
Briggs won't mind if you don't, you know. That's what's so admirable in the dead. They never ask one to do anything they wouldn't do themselves.
Still, I should feel bad if I didn't organise the service.
How would you like to fly to Gibraltar instead, and then take a boat on to England?
My number won't come up for weeks.
But there is an evacuation order, and then there is a social order. I was at school with half of Med Command. I could have them bump you onto the next flight out.
I'm not wild about taking another man's place.
Then you'll be here forever, because other men are cheerfully taking yours. Come on. We can have you away before the Lieutenant Colonel gets to your report. You'll be doing us both a favour. He wouldn't enjoy disciplining you any more than I would.
It would only catch up with me in London instead.
It might not, you know. If this war has taught me anything, it's that no crack is too small for our procedures to fall through.
Listen to us.
Can you imagine us thinking such a thing a year ago? Survival hadn't been invented then. One can hardly blame us for not using something that didn't exist.
Alistair smiled.
How long this war has been, I'll say. One hardly remembers how we lived before. Lightly, not worrying much.
Do you suppose we shall ever live that way again?
Oh, who knows? Given sufficient champagne and ether.
Maybe if we stay drunk to the end of our days, we shan't remember.
That will take systematic drinking. We'll need to stay drunk in cities, towns, and villages, and in the hills and in the fields. How does it go?
And on the beaches and on the landing grounds.
Yes, exactly. We'll have to stay drunk in some inaccessible spots.
And with growing confidence and growing strength in the air, don't forget that. They leaned shoulders companionably and looked out to sea. Perhaps it was true, thought Alistair, that Septembers would come again. People would love the crisp cool of the mornings, and it would not remind them of the week war was declared.
Perhaps there would be such a generation. Blackberries would ripen, carefree hands would pick them, and jam would be poured into pots to cool, and the jam would only taste of jam. People would not save jars of it like holy relics. They would eat it on toast, thinking nothing of it, hardly bothering to look at the label. Alistair let the idea grow, that when the war's heat was spent, the last remaining pilots would ditch their last bombs into the sea and land their planes on cratered airfields that would slowly give way to brambles, that pilots would take off their jackets and ties and pick fruit. He understood that he was finished with the war. He could not stop seeing the enemy airmen choking on yellow dust. He could not stop smelling brigs burning. It was too much. He had given everything that had been asked of him, fighting when fighting could be done, retreating when retreat was wise, and holding fast when it was all that remained. He had not favoured himself, or measured his effort, or taken more than his share. He had done his best to help the men, and now all he wanted was to go home and see if he could help Mary. When set against the great corruption of the war, one's own small rot seemed, if not excusable, than at least unexceptional.
"You know that I joined up voluntarily," said Alistair.
"Bully for you. So?"
"So, will you think less of me if I leave the same way?"
"I'd be furious if you didn't."
Alistair hesitated.
"Then I believe I will take up your kind offer."
"Very sensible. The food on this island really isn't as advertised."
Alistair made to shake Simonson's hand. His right arm surprised him again by not being there, and the lurch almost toppled him. Simonson held him steady.
"I shall pick you up at midnight," he said. "Do try not to fall off the floor in the meantime."
They left the fort on foot, under extravagant stars. A raid came in after they went, and they made their way southwest while the flashes sent their shadows flickering before them on the road. It was 5 miles to the airstrip at Lucca, and they said nothing on the way. Though they walked together, they were distant. Alistair supposed this was the only possible end for a war, when men and women, who had thronged together to join it, made their way home alone. On the airstrip, the Wellington was already running its engines. An orderly hurried across the field to meet them. Alistair felt sick.
"Well," said Simonson, "goodbye."
They shook hands with the left.
"Goodbye,"
said Alistair.
"I can't even begin to..."
"Then don't. Don't begin." "I shall miss you, Douglas." Simonson wiped his eyes.
"Yes, well, let's just hope the enemy does."
They embraced. The orderly helped Alistair up the steps and into the belly of the aircraft. They put him in the companionway, forward of the rear gunner, on top of the mound of mailbags. They lent him a sheepskin coat and told him not to go anywhere the aeroplane wasn't going. The engine noise swelled, the airframe shuddered over the uneven runway, and Malta dropped away into the night. Alistair lay back on the sacks. As soon as the aircraft door was closed, the war was over. The hot, time-scented air of Malta was sealed outside. In here, in the cold, with the smell of sacking and oil, London was already close. They would land at Gibraltar and decant him into a convoy for England. There would be children and women and food and clothes that weren't all brown. Alistair slept until 50 miles from Gibraltar, when the pilot put the aeroplane down on the sea. Alistair came awake in a frenzy of shouting and spray. The incredible deceleration shunted him and all the mailbags up to the navigator's position. Water rose through the rips in the canvas skin of the fuselage. They all got out through the astro hatch. The five of them who had survived the ditching clung to two small rubber rafts. On a warm and glassy sea, they watched as the engine fire that had downed them extinguished itself with a prolonged hissing. A plume of steam rose in the moonlight, and the aircraft sank by the nose. After that, it was quiet. It was a long, chilly pre-dawn, drifting on a flat silver sea beneath a flat silver sky, the weld between the two watertight and seamless. For hours nothing happened, and there was nothing to be done. Then, as the sun rose huge and bloody, a breeze got up from the west. The wind blackened the wide red band that the rising sun made on the water. There was not enough room for them all on the little yellow rafts, so they took turns, two men at a time, to have 15 minutes out of the water. Alistair was given half an hour, his missing arm making it more tiring to tread water. He got his shoes off and let them sink. It occurred to him that this might be the furthest point offshore at which a British Army officer had ever lost a pair of the standard-issue brogues. They could add it to the crimes on his charge sheet. By 9, the sun began to contribute a little warmth, but the wind was increasing. For the men on the rafts, the motion was sickening, and for the men in the water, it was hard to hold on. For Alistair, with only one hand, it was a struggle. From time to time he choked on salt water when he couldn't keep his mouth high enough. The others helped him where they could, but they were tiring too. In his next turn on one of the rafts, a gust came and he toppled into the water. This time he went several feet under, and if he managed to kick back up, it was only because the navigator swam down to help. On the surface he gasped, and only just managed to cling on. He tried not to imagine the odds now. As his strength failed, little things began to amuse him. He thought of the great chain of consequence that had brought him to here, at the end, bobbing in a vast empty sea with four strangers. After everything, a simple engine fire had brought them down. It had happened with no enemy help. Perhaps there was a tiny victory in wartime in not being killed by the war. He laughed and could not understand why the others looked at him so soberly. At noon the wind died down and the wave tops sparkled. They all took their clothes off and let them sink. Alistair drifted in and out of sleep. He would come to, again and again, with his arm hooked through the encircling rope of the raft. Each time he wondered where he was. When the sun set, he didn't notice. He woke up as usual, shivering violently, but this time it was dark. Lightning blazed above. Around him, the men spoke in soft voices.
"When we get to Brighton Pier, I think we should just tie up and have fish and chips, don't you? A pint of beer with mine."
"Tom?" said Alistair.
"Is that you?"
No one replied. The lightning gave them the coldest eyes, he thought. Between the peals of thunder, he heard voices shouting. He strained to hear. Men were calling his name, but he could not tell what they wanted. He called back, but they didn't hear. Their voices resolved into individual shouts that he recognized. He thought it might be his men, needing orders.
"Hold on," he shouted. "Just hold on."
They called louder, and he felt the terror in their voices. He shouted to the men to hold on to the rubber raft with him, if they could, and to pull themselves up out of the sea. He couldn't see them, but he heard their voices, and he comforted them and begged them to pull themselves aboard. There was no moon, and there were no stars. He yelled out that he was sorry, and after shouting for a long time, he noticed that Duggan was clinging to the raft beside him. Alistair was glad, since Duggan would help him now. Duggan would help his men too, and Alistair closed his eyes tight and drifted off. In his sleep, a deeper roar sounded beneath the surging of the waves. The roar increased in volume and broke into his dreams until he came awake with Duggan shaking his shoulder.
"Come on, Heath. Look, lively."
Alistair looked through eyes blinded by salt. Searchlights were coming over the sea. They came from the same place as the roaring. The lights turned the black sea silver. Spray gleamed visible whenever the little rafts climbed to the top of a wave, then disappearing from sight in the troughs. The roaring sound grew enormous. His men began calling him again, and he watched their grey backs plunging all around, and he called out to them as they changed from men to dolphins and back to men again in the shifting beam of the searchlights. Nothing stayed still. The sea heaved, voices yelled all around him, and Alistair felt an unfathomable grief for his men to be lost in such a lonely place, so far from the kindness of sight. He murmured the words he had used at so many burial details. "Comfort us again now after the time that thou hast plagued us, and for the years wherein we have suffered adversity." Spray filled his mouth, and he choked. He lost his grip on the raft, and he was alone in the sea, naked and sinking. Under the waves there were still the lights, cold and holy, cutting the surface above. Simonson was sinking with him. They watched the lights together. Mary was there too, and Tom, and the enemy airmen, and Briggs, and all the men Alistair had lost. Everyone was restored. As the lights and the roaring noise faded, they all sank together through the warm and ageless sea. Duggan took his hand.
"Come on, Heath. Let's get you home."
September 1941. It was 6 weeks since Mary had finally written to Alistair again, and a month since she had received a reply from his commanding officer, a Major Simonson. Alistair was missing in action over the sea, presumed killed. The Major conveyed his regrets and wished her to know that Captain Heath had been a courageous officer who had spoken of her in the gladdest terms. Morphia helped. It threw sorrow over the wall into London, where everyone's tragedies multiplied. One could leave it out there for the time being, in the city of stopped clocks, pending the day when. Mary took to walking. Her leg was improving, though the limp returned if she went too far. She liked to rest on the steps of the National Gallery and look down on Trafalgar Square. It had been months now since the last serious air raid. The square was full of courting couples. How they laughed, as if the blackened world were new already. Every sight was agreeable to them, every diversion gay. Mary had not remembered that there was so much entertainment in watching pigeons squabble in the fountains. She still thought that Alistair might have survived. The authorities might presume a man killed, but that was the authorities for you. To presume was always vulgar, while life was sometimes gracious. In the meantime, she watched the lovers in Trafalgar Square, so as not to forget how it was done. In the bright square, the couples clung, continually adjusting their grip. Now their fingers entwined, now their arms encircled the other's waist, as if life was not at all on their side, as if it might place the tip of its lever into any distance they allowed to open up between them. Watching them, Mary supposed the odds were against her. It was lovers who trusted luck least. She marvelled at the ease with which the young women moved. She watched them laugh and flush. They were all hope and helium, lovely to watch. 2 years ago it had been her. When it got too much, she walked down to the embankment and sat on the granite wall. She ran her fingers over the iron dolphins that swam around the lampposts. Beneath her, the brown water churned with all that was lost, and today she had no more morphia. It had been harder and harder to come by, and now it was gone. As the last of it wore off, she realised that she had no idea how to get more. One often saw bodies at low tide, on the mud spits by the pontoons of the half-finished Waterloo Bridge. Whether they were long dead and only now surrendered by the mud, or whether they were the newly despairing, Mary couldn't tell. Bodies didn't lie cleanly on the ground, the way they did in the cinema. In real life, they appeared not to have been strewn, but sown. The dead were filthy, half-buried, sometimes barely distinguishable from the mud or the rubble they lay in. One didn't understand until one had seen a great many bodies, the unconscious effort that one must be making every minute simply to keep one's hands and face and clothes clean. The world's surfaces were so filthy that the living touched them only with the tips of their fingers and the soles of their shoes. How grubby it was to die, to give up making that effort. Above the mud spits, the lovers never looked down at the dead. Mary watched them clinging tight, their gaze on the horizon. It was a rule that lovers looked east towards the sea. She made herself look that way too. A boat was unloading onto the embankment steps for Parliament, the longshoremen were saying. A case broke open and there were oranges, the first she had seen in months. They rolled across the grey granite and bounced down the mud-brown steps. They splashed into the brown river and sank from sight and bobbed up again, so vivid that she gasped. Tears came to her eyes because she understood how drab the world had become, how grey-brown, how close to fading entirely. She put her hands to her mouth and watched the oranges floating upstream on the tide. They were so, so orange. A confusion crept up on her. The waves rose and fell. The oranges were lost from sight. Was Alistair dead while life continued? It was too startling. She could not remember whether she had received the letter from Major Simonson or whether she had dreamt it. One dreamt so many things. Morphia was utterly convincing, that was the trouble, while life carried on blithely as if it had no competition in the business of conviction, and in consequence seemed less real. And meanwhile, here were all these lovers, legions of them, daring themselves across the scaffold of Waterloo Bridge for the thrill of it. Was it possible that she was not numbered among them? The confusion grew worse until it was terror. Mary covered her eyes. A golden retriever put its paw on the wall where she sat and licked her face. Mary looked up to find it nose to nose with her. The dog was hopelessly tight on life, as if it had taken 45 times the recommended dose. It inclined its head, blinked at her, and trembled with unguarded joy.
"Hello, you," said Mary.
A man appeared, tall, uniformed, RAF. "I'm so sorry."
"Why, what have you done?"
said Mary, producing by instinct a small grin. The man laughed.
"The dog, silly. Oh, look here, are you all right?"
"It's nothing. Please don't worry. I'll be fine in just a moment."
"But you're upset. Can I do anything? Can I stand you a cup of tea?"
Mary stared up at the man. Of course, he was ablaze with consolations. But when she opened her mouth to say something in her usual vein, Mary simply couldn't. His looks made her ache. His kindness left her miserable. She felt his negative image, the absence a man left.
"I'm sorry," she said. "Please, just go."
"But you're upset," he said again, his head inclined to the same angle the dog had adopted, as if all degrees of upset might very simply be cured, perhaps by throwing a stick. How nice it would be to link arms with him, to go to a cafe.
"If only I weren't dead," she thought.
"I'm sorry," she said again, and fled. Her limp was worse, and pains shot through her body.
Several times she became confused once more and had to stop. It had started raining without her noticing, and now the blacked-out night crept up on her too. Music rose from the dancing cellars. The swing beat boomed, and a hot steam of exhaled smoke and body vapours rose through the air vents and grills, as if the city were formed from the magma of such rhythms, cooled to a provisional solidity by the sober English rain. She felt alternately distraught and euphoric. Sometimes she stumbled, and at other moments it seemed to her that she moved with no effort, gliding left and right to let the umbrellas pass, 1, 2, 3, waltzing on the pavement while the cellars swung beneath her. London had always had this trick of living in two time signatures at once, the urgent and the always, each in earshot of the other. She realised with a cold sweat that she probably ought not to go back to the garret alone and without the benefit of morphia. It was the same feeling she'd had by the river. Not that she might do away with herself, but that she might not know the difference if she did. It was queer the way things crept, the night and these feelings. One was brought up to scorn the tendency to despair, but it seemed that the darkness knew this and found a way to reach one nevertheless. It was patient and subtle, gauging the heart's output of light. Her confusion grew, the heart loosened, and the mind lucifugous, the great clash of music in an endlessly accelerating rush, on and on and on. She came to, the steam from the nightclubs rising around her, surprised to find her cigarette only half smoked. She felt a fear that was close to panic, and hurried off again.
She didn't stop until she reached the Lyceum. The minstrel show was going on in the auditorium, and she went in through the stage door from the alleyway. In the basement it was quiet, except for the laughter and applause from above. The children were sitting on the low raised stage where the band had played during the worst months of the bombing. The nightclub had gone back above ground now. Zachary was at an upright piano, while Molly and Charles argued, and Ruth, a new arrival, moped in the corner. When Zachary saw her, he stopped playing.
"What happened?"
"I'm quite all right," she said, giving the children a bright smile. "I think I might just sit down for a moment." She woke hours later, wrapped in blankets. Her body was wet with sweat and racked with unsparing pain. Molly was holding her hand. Zachary was kneeling beside her, laying a cloth on her forehead.
"You fainted,"
Molly said. She sat and looked around. Her joints were packed with hot glass.
"Oh,"
she said.
"Oh."
Zachary turned to Molly.
"Go off and play."
Mary collected herself. "Zachary," she said in her teaching voice,
"would you find whoever handles these things among the players and fetch me just one dose of morphia?"
Then she added, with perfect cunning,
"Say it isn't for me."
But his face, as though she had asked him to murder someone. It was too bad that she had taught him geometry but no sense of proportion.
"Do go, won't you? There must be some around here." "I can. But it is perfectly simple. Just put your shoes on and go."
He wouldn't meet her eyes.
"Have a cigarette instead."
He took them from her bag and lit one for each of them. She didn't try to forbid him, and so, without fuss, he passed from her power. She almost laughed. He watched the glowing end as if it contained lost summers, then stubbed out the cigarette half-smoked, not crushing it, but rolling the point until it was extinguished to keep for later. Mary smoked hers till it blistered her lip.
"Please," she said.
He lifted a strand of hair from her eyes and tucked it behind her ear, his no the louder for going unspoken. Her mood, which had cooled to a pale despair, now boiling over again into furious irritation.
"After everything I've done for you. You act the man, but you are an ungrateful child. I might have known your sort would never come right."
He shrugged.
"But you are incorrigible," she said,
unable to stop a miserable grin curling at the corners of her mouth.
"You are a lazy, unappreciative nigger who will not lift a finger to help."
He said nothing. She raised a warning hand.
"Don't look at me like that. I'm from a good family, and if it weren't for you, I'd be with them now. I wish I'd never come looking for you. I wish I'd never come to this nasty jigaboo club."
Zachary didn't change his expression at all. The light seemed to be dimming, and she did not know if they had any candles. She did not know if candles were still available. She was not convinced that light was still manufactured. Her anger was gone. She did not remember ever being angry. There was only a feeling of dread, of the darkness finding its way. And here was the boy. She shivered in her blankets as his eyes became Alistair's. She moaned and turned away. Now, finally, the full gaze of the war came upon her. Her mind was fragments, each loud with its voices. She fought to keep one image of herself alive at the centre. She was rushing across town with a willing heart to a point marked with an X. She was wearing her alpine sweater. Yes, that was it. But war had been declared, and it was thrilling, and then it was terrible. The heaviest thing about life was that it began with a lightness of heart.
"You mustn't have any more morphia," said Zachary.
Her eyes snapped open, and she stared at him, wondering how it was possible that he was still here, unchanged, when she had gripped the blankets and shut her eyes tight through the terror of eternity.
"What?"
she whispered.
"No more." "Just a little, don't you see? Just to take the edge off?" "No, please, no. You're cruel because you don't yet understand,"
she said, and closed her eyes. She slept, and when she woke, her mind was clear. Alistair had arrived. She sat up, her heart soaring. He was just as she had last seen him, on the platform at Waterloo. He cupped her face in his hands and she let herself be kissed. Orange sparks floated on the night. The cold air of the basement made her shiver, and she held him for his warmth. Oh, the slow dances they used to play, back when needles could still be found for the gramophones. His eyes were electric bulbs, and